Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Call of Nature podcast. We are a grassroots podcast about nature, wildlife, people, the environment, and we are for everyday people just like you. Now, this is the first episode of season 2, so we've been away for a little while, but we're back and we're very happy to be back. In this episode, we've got some really cool stuff. We've got a chat that Pete and Gareth had with Kelly Herrick, and they talk about connecting with nature through art and creativity. We've then got a little thing that I made about leaves and why they change colour and fall off trees in autumn. And then we've also got a chat with Amanda Whittington. We're introducing her as a new member of the team, which is very exciting. And she's going to tell us a bit about how she got into nature and also some stuff about adders.
Would you like somebody to read the disclaimer, Chris?
Oh, yeah. I was just looking at my notes saying, oh, no, what comes next? Gareth, would you mind reading the disclaimer bit so we can start swearing?
The views and opinions expressed in the Call of Nature are those of whoever expressed them and do not reflect those of any other organisation or agency.
There we go. On the show today, I'm joined by my two glamorous co-hosts. They're not my co-hosts. I don't own them. I don't like take them out of a box and like plug them, put a microphone in front of them. They're just normal people. Say hi, Pete and Gareth.
Hi.
Hi. I just say it sounds like we have to walk down the street with you and just big you up whenever you want us to.
What's the thing? What's in hip hop when you've got like the main rapper and then there's the other two guys who just sort of say the odd word behind them?
Are they the entourage?
Is it entourage? There's probably a word for it. We should know that. Nah.
Backing vocalists?
I don't think it's backing in
I feel so old.
I'll Google it in a second and we'll find out. But yeah, I see you guys as those guys.
Cheers.
Sorry. I don't at all. I'm joking. Anyway, have you got any nature highlights that you guys have seen or heard over the past few weeks that you might share with our listeners?
Yeah, I had a nice one last week. I went for a walk along with a good friend of mine along the coast. I live in Devon on the south coast, near the south coast, and we went for a stroll from a beach, I can't remember what it's called, to Brixham. And just as we got to Brixham, where the kind of sea defences and stuff start, behind the harbour wall, there was a seal swimming about. And it was right by the rocks, you know, it was just, I don't know, 10 yards away from me. And as I was looking at it, I realised it had some a fish or something. And then when I looked more closely, I realised it had about half a conger eel. And this thing must have been about half of about a 20 or 30 pound conger eel that it had caught.
Wow.
And it was busy chomping away on it. I've hardly ever seen seals. I've been a bit unlucky, you know, considering I wander around quite a lot looking for things. It turned out there were three of them. Yeah, one of them was eating this massive great eel and everyone was standing around watching it. It was an amazing thing to see. And I managed to shoot a bit of video, which you can see on our Instagram profile if you're interested.
Yeah, I'll have a look at that. Conger eels are huge, aren't they? They're evil looking things, really. Of course, yeah. They're not evil, but they look quite intimidating.
They can get really, really big. This was like, I don't know, a kind of middle aged one, I guess. This seal was enjoying him for his lunch, I can tell you.
When you say middle age, I've got an impression that he had like just bought himself a convertible sports car or something.
Don't offend our listeners with convertible sports cars, Gareth.
I'm planning my own.
And Gareth, what have you seen or heard recently?
So it's fungi season. So I went out to the woods recently, and one of the ones you can see quite obviously is this thing called the yellow stagshorn fungus. It's often in conifer woodlands. It can be growing out of the sort of the trunks or stumps of trees that have been cut down, and it's a beautiful fluorescent orange, really bright, all jaggedy. It looks almost like a bit of coal that's been just chucked in the middle of the woodland out of place, and that's all over the place at the moment, but it's lovely.
Ooh, what's that called again, Gareth?
Well, that's the yellow stagshorn fungus.
Nice.
Oh, I might have to Google that. That sounds good.
Did you send over a photo of that, Gareth?
I did indeed, yes.
Oh, in that case, that's also on our Instagram profile, so you can have a look at that as well, Chris.
Oh, great. My highlight, I went to my sister's house last week. She lives sort of in Buckinghamshire Way and out in the middle of the sticks. And as I was pulling up to outside her house, I saw and heard this. So it was about dusk, about sort of maybe 7:30, something like that. And there was a huge roost of jackdaws and rooks and crows. There must have been thousands, if not tens of thousands of birds all coming in to sleep at the same time. And this is a thing at this time of year. It's a thing, certainly it's a cool thing that listeners can look out for at sort of sunset. If there's big clumps of big old trees, quite often you get these winter roosts of corvids, like jackdaws and crows and things like that. And I did a bit of internet research, and apparently the reason why they do it is to sort of come and exchange information, they can't prove that, but that's one of the theories, but also to gain a bit of safety from predators, you know, safety in numbers kind of thing. And quite often a lot of them are juveniles, so they'll be birds that might have hatched this spring and this might be their first winter. So they're sort of, you know, just like humans do, you get sort of adolescents sort of like gathering in groups at dusk. Now I sound truly old and middle-aged.
You better get a convertible sports car, Chris.
Yeah, maybe. Starlings or a motorbike. Starlings are the ones that get the headlines, aren't they, with the big swirly sort of murmurations that you see on like cool nature videos and stuff like that. But it turns out that jackdaws and rooks do the same thing. So that was fun.
Nice.
Excellent.
Well, there we are. So while we've been away having our season break, we've all been connecting with nature, as you'd expect. You'll have noticed that we're keen on doing that sort of thing. We're also keen, of course, on encouraging other people to get outside and enjoy nature. Something that I've become increasingly aware of as we're doing this is that Gareth, Chris and I, we're all quite similar in regard to the fact that when we go outside, we're quite keen on identifying stuff. We're always looking at the animals and the birds. We're always looking at the plants, and we're all quite keen on figuring out what things are and sort of making a mental note of what we've seen. But what we've realised more recently is that not everybody likes that. A lot of people go out and enjoy nature and they don't give a monkey's what bird that is just flew past, and they don't think about that stuff. They just like being out there. And other people, there's a whole range of different things you can go out and do in nature and have meaningful connections. And we recently had a chat with Kelly. We had a very interesting conversation learning about how she engages with nature and encourages others to do the same. Well, it's the first today, everybody, on the Call of Nature. We're about to have a conversation about the role of creativity in nature connectedness. We're going to talk with Kelly Herrick, who's a landscape artist and creative wellbeing coach. Thank you for joining us today, Kelly.
My pleasure. It's lovely to be here.
We really try to encourage people to go out and get to places like woodlands, and you do the same, but you're trying to get them to do it a bit differently, be a bit more creative about it. Could you tell us a bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. We are currently running some workshops and art gatherings, if you like, outdoors in nature. And we're running some art workshops and creativity workshops in our local woodland in partnership with our Woodland Community Trust.
Excellent. And so when people come along to your workshops, what sort of thing can they expect?
So first of all, we start off by really trying to connect with nature, as we're talking about on this podcast, and trying to open up our senses, be in the present moment and really observe some of the simple pleasures and some of nature unfolding around us before we even start to be creative, get in the zone and get a bit of space, headspace.
And what sort of reactions do you get? Have you got anyone who comes along who's been a bit forced along but then suddenly discovers that it's a bit transformational for them?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because I had one lady join us on the last woodland walk and sketch. And she said, we go through at the end, you know, what have we learned? What have we taken away from today? And she said, I was so stressed today. I was running around and dashing around. And actually just taking the time to be here in this woodland and, you know, calm down and create something from nature has really calmed me and put me in a peaceful mood. So yeah, I felt like my mission there was achieved for sure.
You can't get a better view than that, can you?
No, I mean, that's what it's about. It's about creative well-being, not about whether you produce an amazing piece of art or not. It's about connecting.
Brilliant.
That's great, Kelly. And I know that something you're interested in is a piece of work called Pathways into Nature Connectedness, and especially the creative aspect and the science around that. Would you tell us a bit more about that, please?
Yeah, it's something that Miles Richardson and the University of Derby team have been researching for a number of years. And I'm a Derbyshire-based artist as well. So for me, it was really interesting to go along to the lecture and hear about this. But there are certain pathways that help us connect our sense of self to nature. And some of those are really integrated with our sense of creativity as well. So things like senses and tuning into nature through our senses, things like becoming alive and feeling emotional connection, and also noticing the beauty of nature. Obviously, those three things are really, really powerful and important when you're trying to create a piece of artwork that's inspired by nature.
I think the creativity thing is really interesting for me. I mean, one of the things I'm really passionate about is tackling the lack of diversity in the environment sector, the art environment, industry, people into nature, the whole lot. And I know in the sort of, there's been a perception for many years that in the more traditional sort of arts movement that there was also a lack of diversity, but it feels there's been some real solid action to address that. And I just wondered if there's anything you think that people who are into nature can learn from some of the things that have been successful in the art sector.
Yeah, I think there's quite a lot of things that have happened from doing things in unexpected locations. So, for example, our woodland walk and sketch, we didn't go up into the Peak District. It wasn't dramatic. We went to our very local sort of suburban woodlands that's right on our doorstep, and then doing things in a way that you perhaps wouldn't expect. So it would be very, very traditional to go and do a ramble or maybe take photography as well, because people are quite used to that. But actually to do some creative play and exploration whilst you're in a woodland environment is very, very different. So I think that opens up to people who might not necessarily just want to go and walk or just want to go and you know, spot animal life or something like that. It really gives people layers and experience and immersion in nature itself.
So the sort of experiences that people have in, even though it sounds like they're not going very far, they're having sort of, what would you say, it's a sort of a deeper experience than they would have if they spent loads of time and walked, you know, let's say rambled for miles through the countryside?
Yeah, I think there's benefits in both. I love to walk myself, but I think the sort of quiet observation and then the self-expression of the nature around you that comes from that makes a really strong emotional connection. And this is what the nature connectedness is about, is creating that strength of connection to make you feel well, but then also to have compassion and act on that to conserve our wonderful landscapes and nature as well. So it really does form strong connections, but then prompt wonderful, hopefully wonderful, conservation action from people as well.
That's great. Something Gareth and I and Chris were chatting about the other day was that a lot of the time when we try and get people into nature, it's all about IDing stuff, which is fun for a lot of people. But I think it's great that you're identifying other things that people can go and do in nature here. And something else that you said when we chatted earlier, Kelly, was about how everybody knows that going for a walk around the woods is good for you. But what you told me was that a higher quality experience actually maximizes the effect of well-being upon people. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm awful at identifying. For a landscape artist, I'm terrible at identifying stuff. I think I can pick out an oak tree and, you know, a few of the more basic things. But it doesn't matter, because what happens is that when you're in that environment and when you're really observing and opening your senses, you know, it's about quality over quantity of connection to the environment. And instead of identifying the tree and knowing all the scientific facts, you're putting your hands on it and you're feeling the texture and you're listening to the leaves blowing in the wind, and you're trying to capture the color, of, you know, the sunlight as it hits the foliage. And that really builds this strong personal connection and unique experience. And I think we're moving to experience over things very much in our society. And I think people want these simple pleasures and connections and experiences. And they form a much stronger bond than necessarily walking past that same tree 20 times. It's about taking time and making a connection that's unique to your sense and your sense of self.
And I wonder if all the people who go out and sort of like to count and ID things, they subconsciously, it's the experience, like you're saying, Kelly, that is making them want to go and do it again. Because I've looked at some of your paintings, and I've got to say, I know absolutely nothing about art, but for someone who spends a lot of time outdoors in the sort of places you paint, they sort of really capture the sort of the feeling of what it's like to be in those places. It's amazing. Like, I definitely hang one on my wall, but it's just that whole
sense of
you've really captured that. I was looking at one, there's one of a woodland. It's like, that is what it's like to feel like you're in a woodland. So I think actually even those of us who sort of are very sciencey approach to how we engage with nature, so we might not always admit it, but actually the feeling, emotive part of it's important.
Yeah, totally. And I think that people express that in different ways. And I think maybe those collectors and identifiers are, you know, striving to keep that emotional connection going by being there regularly and seeing things that they like, because we have different styles of learning and playing as well. Some people are collectors, some people are creators. And I think having these multiple ways for us all to connect to our landscape and our nature is just ideal, because there are so many ways then to become involved and connected and part of our actual world. You know, our actual world isn't our houses. Our actual world is here all around us.
Brilliantly said.
Yeah, couldn't agree more, Kelly. So it's been great chatting with you. Now, I know that on social media you are at I Am Kelly Herrick Art. That's HERRICK Art. How would people get hold of you on your website, Kelly, if they'd like to know more about your workshops and your art?
Yeah, I love people getting in touch. We have some great conversations. So kellyherrick.com, and it's Kelly with Y. All my events and workshops and art, and you'll find everything on there.
Thanks, Kelly. I mean, that was really inspiring and fascinating for me. So really great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks very much, Kelly.
Oh, it's been a joy and a pleasure. Thank you.
I really enjoyed talking to Kelly, because it reminded me that actually going out and just interacting and playing with nature can be really fun. And I often come across really seriously as someone who wants to identify stuff, but I've got a big secret that actually I'm a massive kid. And a lot of the time I'm just sort of larking around and enjoying myself out in nature. And that's what Chris has been doing just now when he's been out kicking leaves.
The sound you just heard was me kicking my way through a wonderful pile of dry, brown, orange and gold leaves in my local woods. It's something which you can do all over the UK at this time of year, and it's a lot of fun, to be honest. I've been doing it ever since I was a kid, but it set me thinking, why do the trees lose their leaves at this time of year? What's the reason for it? And how does it work? So, I did a little bit of internet research, and I thought I'd share it with you. Trees, like all green plants, use a chemical called chlorophyll in order to convert sunlight into energy. Now in the winter, there's much less sunlight, and also water is a much more precious commodity. As the ground gets colder and with the possibility of freezing, trees are going to find it hard to draw up water through their roots. Green leaves have a lot of water in them. They need it in order to photosynthesize and for the leaf to work. If that water freezes in the leaf and makes ice crystals, they can cause a lot of cell damage. So the whole idea of photosynthesis in the winter becomes a lot less attractive. So why do leaves change colour in the autumn? Well, leaf colour comes from pigments. These are natural substances that are produced by the leaf cells in order to help them obtain food. The first pigment that people are familiar with, and I mentioned earlier, is chlorophyll, and that makes leaves green. But there are also things called carotenes, which are yellow, and anthocyanins, which are red. In autumn, chlorophyll starts getting broken down into other things like fats and carbohydrates, which the trees use as a useful energy store back down in the roots and the trunk. And that will keep them ticking over the winter
and also provide a good reliable source of energy when it comes to producing new leaves in spring and summer when the weather conditions get a bit better. Of course, once the leaf loses this chlorophyll, it's these other coloured chemicals which start becoming more visible in the leaf, hence the wonderful autumn colours that we're all familiar with. Most trees in the UK adopt a strategy of abandoning photosynthesis in winter. You know, the lack of water and light means it's not really an effective way to keep their energy and food production systems going. So instead, they lose the leaves and grow new ones once the weather conditions become more favourable. As the days shorten and temperatures start to cool, trees produce a hormone called auxin. And what auxin does is it affects the cells around where the leaf stem joins a branch, and it causes the joint to become really brittle and fragile. And after a while, the wind just blows the leaf clean off the tree, and it snaps off, giving a clean break. Another reason for losing your leaves over winter, if you're a tree, is that you're better able to survive winter storms. So strong winds will move through a leafless tree much more easily, not putting so much pressure on it. So they're much less likely to get blown over, basically. So there we go. By breaking down the chlorophyll in their leaves and turning them from bright green to yellow, brown and orange, and eventually losing them altogether, trees have this wonderful survival mechanism. Well, they shut up shop for winter, basically. It's mind-boggling to think of all the billions and billions of leaves produced every spring, only to be discarded every autumn all over the world every year. It's a fantastic process in nature, and it obviously works brilliantly. Of course, it also means that every September and October, I can kick through the leaves in my local woods, just like I did ever since I was a small child.
Yeah, that was lovely, Chris. I remember messing about with dried leaves when I was a kid in the autumn as well. And I can tell you that that hasn't changed. My little boy on the way home from school the other day found a pile of leaves and he loved kicking them all out from a little alcove they were in onto the pavement where the wind caught them and was blowing them all away. And it was a lovely thing to see.
Yeah, it's something that no one should grow out of. You know, keep doing it. It's part of autumn.
Yeah.
I'm interested, actually, Gareth, if there's any bits and bobs that I got wrong in that, because I know, like, with your science brain, you'd be analysing it. And also, you probably got some other stuff to tell us about leaves.
Well, firstly, Chris, I'd say I was practically salivating at all the science you were kicking out. So welcome to the dark side. May you never return.
Oh, thanks.
But it's really interesting about what leaf senescence, this act of leaves dying, is such a hot topic for research, because when you think about what it actually means, it links directly to the food we eat. So if you can delay senescence, you can extend the growing season of things like rice and crops that we eat. And also, if you're thinking about carbon capture for trees, again, if you have a longer growing season, you can capture more carbon. So there's a huge, rich vein of research into this about, you know, how do you keep things growing for longer? And what's really interesting, obviously, is climate change plays a big role, but it's really complicated. So generally what triggers leaves to sort of die off is a combination of light, daylight changing, but also temperature and water stress. But depending on the slight balance of those three factors, you get a different response. So in theory, in the UK, if we daylight won't change unless we kick the earth off its tilt, but we will see, which hopefully doesn't happen, but we will see warmer days coming forwards. So that would say that you'd get a longer growing season and autumn will start to happen later and later. But when you get water stress, what you see is it actually kicks it forward. So you get autumn earlier and earlier. So where places in the Mediterranean where you're getting longer drought periods, actually the growing season's getting shorter and shorter for crops and for trees and for wildlife. So it's really interesting. And but what we like to see in Britain is actually a longer growing season, because we're likely to have more very wet weather, and we're likely to have warmer, wetter weather. So we're probably going to get a longer growing season for trees. And you think that's great for them, but what it doesn't do is enable them to shut down in winter. And a lot of the pests that would actually affect trees really need that cold period to kill them off, and trees rely on it. So it's a fantastic, fascinating area of science that's a really hot topic for climate change.
Wow. Didn't think of all those things. There's such a fine balance of all these different factors in something as simple as a leaf falling off a tree.
And if you think about it, in sort of rainforests, most trees, even sort of broadleaf trees, are evergreen because they don't have that trigger.
That's what I was thinking. Did you call it senescence?
Senescence, yes.
That's a lovely word, isn't it? Is it something that only really happens in our sort of temperate regions, you know, not close to the equator, where is this more pronounced difference in the weather of the seasons?
I mean, all trees do shed leaves. It's a good way to get rid of sort of excess sort of toxins and things you don't want. But the sort of the real big seasonal shedding of leaves is very much something you get in these sort of temperate areas, whether it's north or south of the equator.
Well, that's fascinating stuff, fellas. Lovely. So now, everybody, it's very exciting here at the Call of Nature this week. As you may have heard in the final episode of season one, we announced that we were going to hopefully unveil a new team member in episode 9. That's what we're going to do now. We've been joined by Amanda, who's brand new to the team. And here's a chat which Chris and I had with her just the other day.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be on the podcast today. Really looking forward to having a chat with you both.
Yeah, likewise. Hello from me as well.
Oh, hi, Pete. Yeah, great to be here.
So way back in episode 1, when we first started the podcast, Pete, Gareth and I talked just a little bit about what got us into nature in the first place. Maybe, Amanda, you could tell us about what got you interested in nature.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a valley in the Lake District and was lucky to be surrounded by nature. But I think what really got me into it was when my dad took me down to a pond, a natural pond in the field near our house during the frog mating season. And as we were walking down, there was this kind of magical sound of all the croaking. It was almost like the song out of Rupert and the Frog Song. And I was fascinated to see all these kind of writhing bodies of the frogs on top of each other and jostling each other. And all the frog spawn kind of all felt all nice and sort of jellyish to touch. And I just really sort of fell in love with frogs at that point. So I used to go to that pond a lot and study them. And then we had a couple of ponds in the garden too, which I used to study. And I was looking for frogs and newts and toads and just really obsessed with like being able to watch that whole process from like spawn to baby frog or newt. Mm. And I just found it fascinating kind of waiting for them to appear. And I was quite patient, sort of hunched over these ponds. And also just generally into looking at logs and, looking for all sorts of nature around and about. But now I've got children. I've kind of really got back into kind of studying nature with them. So we've been going on walks, lots of nature walks, particularly in lockdown, looking for different sort of species and kind of taking little identification books out and, having a good time looking for new things. And
that sounds fun.
Yeah, it's been great. And obviously I'm aware of things that are going on with the environment and climate change and everything else. And just want to pass on that enthusiasm to them too.
That's cool. That's cool. So I've got to ask, Amanda, we're just getting to know each other here, aren't we? So so what I want to know is, are you kind of on me and Chris's side of things, or are you more of a sort of Gareth type of person? So when we were chatting before, you said that you, when you were little, you were breeding newts. So was this a big setup with lots of tanks and you were kind of keeping lists of the bloodlines and or was it more looking in a pond?
We had sort of, there was like a tin pond as well as like an old bath and another pond around. So I used to sometimes take a male and a female, I think, out the bath pond in the tin pond with some pond weeds and then wait for the eggs to appear. I was kind of quite a specialist, wealth of knowledge at that age when I was in primary school on those subjects. But I wouldn't call myself an expert.
And how extensive were your notes?
Well, what I did at primary school was I actually made a magazine called The Naturalist Monthly. Only one ever got made, actually. But it was a full magazine with like facts about frogs and newts and stuff, a cartoon, adopt a frog section, competitions. Wow. Yeah, it was kind of, and pictures.
I wish I'd gone to your school. We would have gotten like a house on fire.
Yeah, that sounds like the sort of thing I would have enjoyed doing as well, Amanda. So something, as you know, that we ask listeners to contact us with is a magic moment. And we thought while we were getting to know you during our chat today, it would be a good thing to get you to do a magic moment or a nature place. And I know that the one that you've picked is a magic moment, isn't it? So why don't you tell everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. During lockdown, I went on lots of nature walks, as I was mentioning before. And we were looking around a local nature reserve cemetery, looking for lizards, which we've recently
discovered. A cemetery? Would this be the same cemetery that Gareth and Chris are always hanging around in?
It is indeed, yes, in Stroud. A host of wildlife you can find there, which is brilliant. We'd found some lizards basking in the sun on some of the headstones the week before. Which was quite exciting because we hadn't really noticed them much before. And we'd heard also there's adders in the cemetery and slow worms and glow worms, as Chris found out. We went on a little nature walk through the cemetery. It was quite a hot day, but it was quite overcast, so we thought we wouldn't see much. And within half an hour, we saw an adder, which was amazing. I've been waiting to see another for like 40 years. So that was great. Yeah, it was just like coiled up on the path, right next to the path in like a figure of eight, just totally motionless. And we all saw it, me, my partner, my seven-year-old and three-year-old. And yeah, it was an amazing experience to see an adder finally. I just kind of like the idea that they're a bit dangerous as well. It's kind of quite exciting to see one. I'd always wanted to see one, and so yeah, that was definitely a magic moment. We then 2 minutes later saw a giant slow worm and saw about 10 lizards as well, so that was a great nature day.
Yeah, that sounds great.
I really need to get to this cemetery of yours, Chris.
It's not mine. For listeners who might not have seen an adder before or know what they look like, can you describe one to us?
Yeah, it was it has black and it had sort of grey markings, you know, kind of zigzag patterned, and it was all coiled up in like a figure of eight. It was very still, the one that we saw. It eventually slivered off, but it had, I think, I'm not that great with, because it was all coiled up, I'm not exactly sure on the measurements of it, but maybe about a metre.
It felt big.
Yeah, it felt quite big. Yeah, it's quite chunky. Yeah. So,
so following your experience, did you go and find out more about adders?
Yeah, I did actually. I had to do a little bit of more research. I wanted to know, a bit more about it. So, yeah, I found out that was a male adder because the males have like black and grey markings, and the females have like more brown and dark brown or black markings. So that was interesting. And then I stumbled across this amazing video of called the Adder Dance. Highly recommend Googling the Adder Dance. And basically the males in the mating season, they kind of do this dance where they like intertwine with each other, trying to push each one to the ground. And they can do it for like up to 2 weeks, I think even longer sometimes. And it's the last one stand, the one with the most stamina that then gets to mate with the female. But they don't hurt each other in any of it. So it's quite beautiful to watch. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think I might have seen that actually once a long time ago. But they kind of, they sort of writhe around with each other, don't they?
Yeah. It's really brilliant how you can see something new and then like this adder and then go and like look on, you know, on Google, do a bit of research, maybe look in a book, perhaps find out more. It really opens your eyes to new things. I never even knew about this adder dance before. And now it's going to be high up on my list to see the adder dance.
Well, that's an amazing thing to see, Amanda. I've rarely seen an adder, and I've certainly never seen him having a two-week fight in a cemetery near where I live. So fair play to you for that. It's been lovely starting to get to know you on the Call of Nature. I'm really excited that you're joining the team. We all are. And I'm looking forward to working with you on some more stuff very soon.
Yeah, likewise, Amanda. I'm really looking forward to us having some fun making some recordings.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks for having me on, and I'm really looking forward to the next time. Thanks, guys.
So that was great talking to Amanda, And we're all really looking forward to her joining us on the next episode. And I know she is too. And something actually for all of our listeners to bear in mind is that we're all really open to anyone getting involved in this podcast. So if you are a budding David Attenborough, or you've just got a story that made you smile and you want to share it, or if you just want to come on the show and muck around with us, we'd be more than happy to have you involved.
That's right, Chris. Please do contact us, everybody. Lots of people have been. We've had some great chats and recordings recently, which we're looking forward to putting out soon. And let's have a lot more of that, please, folks. So, Gareth, I've got a question for you as our resident wildlife expert. I was interested by everything Amanda had to say, but I was particularly interested in the adder dance, which is actually, it turns out, an adder fight, which goes on for 2 weeks, which that seems like an extraordinary amount of time to have a fight, especially if it's 24 hours a day. So is it the case, Gareth, that these adders are literally wrestling for 2 solid weeks, or do they somehow at dusk maybe have a break and go to bed and then reconvene at breakfast time and carry on? How does that work?
Well, I think my understanding is that the 2 week one tends to happen in captivity and you've got nothing better to do. But out in the wild, it tends to be a shorter fight. And I'd love to say that there's skill and tactics and you have sort of ninja adders involved, but it tends to be the biggest and the largest just smashes the other one and it's over a lot swifter than 2 weeks.
Ah, I see. And one other question, Gareth. Breeding newts, that sounds fun. It also sounds like the sort of thing that you might have got up to as a kid. Did you breed any animals when you were little?
I wish I was allowed to breed animals when I was little, but no, I think, yeah, sitting in the garden in a bin blind looking at dragonflies was as much as my parents could take.
So that's it for episode 9 of The Call of Nature. Episode 10 will be out on the 28th of October, where we will be joined by Amanda and possibly talking about another new team member, which we're quite excited about too. Now, if you've enjoyed what you've heard so far, if you'd be so kind as to give us a rating or a review, that would be really good for us. And also, you can find us on all of the social media platforms where you'll be able to see some of the pictures of the stuff that we've talked about on today's episode. So that's it from us. This was the first episode of season 2, and it feels really good to be back, doesn't it, chaps?
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see you in the next one.
See ya.
Bye, folks.